I don't know if like there's a like sort of the equivalent of like for freshers go next year for this module, a sort of like a dummy's guide to how to read it.
Mm-hmm.
Or like, because I know that there's like how to approach each like author and like essay, because they're all so different, and for example, like some things are very cryptic and it's just the first time I've ever come across mm-hmm. things like that. So maybe you'd like to make them prepared for that. So if you want to be a better author, of course, like take a look at this. And any suggested like reading or like a PowerPoint on how to approach it. Just because I felt like, because a lot of people have done something and I felt like
that. Right, okay. So you think simply a sort of short introduction that I would sort of either write or give you, or really some substantial texts in preparation?
Maybe if you wrote how to, like how you think is the best way to approach it, and just mm-hmm. any like books that come to your head online. But even just some like generic information.
Okay, I mean I'll talk about the issue of secondary in a moment, but I can think about that. And I mean the issue with Marx being present, the thing is that usually people read the different texts and read them differently. And if you look at, so the sort of, that's why I talk quite a lot about the kind of received view. It's all about class struggle and so on. That's normally the view, maybe not in the English department because they would be interested in subject formation and stuff like that. But if you normally come across Marx out in the wild, it would usually be a focus on that and not so much on the kind of text we read. So that's why I thought it would be interesting to show you a sort of different side of the same theorist, but precisely because he is sort of very present and a lot of people refer to him and so on. But yeah, I mean, that's all interesting, so I'll think about how I deal with that. But any other things that weren't quite clear to me?
I think, sorry to say as well, I think that's like what I said in my personal duty meeting as well, about maybe just, I don't know, having some sort of guide as to what will be like dealing with within modernity as well. So I know the module description does like hint on it, but maybe like clearly setting out about like we'll be looking at capitalism and religion and things like that.
Okay.
Because I remember at the start I wasn't entirely sure about that. Obviously I knew it was called modernity and so it's intense, so like within that you kind of know what's going to be happening,
uh-huh.
but maybe just a clearer idea of the themes that would...
Yeah, I mean that could be easily done, definitely.
Yeah.
Okay. And in terms of pace, do you think we went a bit too slow, say for the Freud or for any other parts? Or? There was also like one or two people said that and the other one people said that.
I thought the Freud was the best pace.
Uh-huh. And some people said they didn't really want to go through it sort of paragraph by paragraph, which I, you know, in the literary module I wouldn't do that either, but I thought, well, these are really hard texts, so it's maybe good to see, well, okay, what is actually the argument and how does it develop? Was that a bit too plodding, or did you feel that way? I thought maybe for the Zimmer we could be more sort of theme oriented.
Maybe sometimes to like mix it up a bit. Because I think if people aren't like, I don't know, people don't, not everyone likes speaking in seminars as much.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps like the PowerPoint's not just being like purely contextual, maybe some stuff, like some questions on the PowerPoint to talk about in groups, or like trying to do some of the presentation to do with the text as well. I don't know.
Yeah, sometimes I felt like, because it was a seminar, it was like very much student-led,
mm-hmm.
and actually that's like, on one hand a good thing, but if there's, like on the other hand, like people are a bit weary just because they don't, like, no one is going to assume that they completely understood it.
Okay.
So I think maybe if like led a bit more, like just so we get a bit more sure of ourselves.
You mean sort of more input from me about
yeah.
Okay, these are sort of broad arguments here or these are the main themes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I'm not
sure. I think it's quite a context of it, maybe at times people might have felt slightly out of their depth or whatever
mm-hmm.
and didn't want to say what they think.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe just, yeah, like Eddie says, like leaders into the right gut path.
Okay, well that's actually really useful. I actually felt that a lot of people said things, so I mean, I take your point completely, but just as a sort of compliment to you, I was actually quite impressed by the level of participation, given that in such a hard place. But yeah, if that would help, I'm very happy to do that. Yeah, thanks. I think that was most what I just thought I'd need a bit more feedback on. Thank you very much. That was useful. Okay, I mean, I don't want to...
Can I ask a question? So, because I'm sort of, I'm not too sure because I've never done, like, horseback like this before. Like, obviously I've done them for other modules, but this is a very, like, the material's so different. And, like, the depth we went into in our seminars, like, if that's very well written, would that have the potential to get a first, or does it have to go much deeper? Because, like, I do have friends who do, like, degrees in, like, philosophy or, like, politics and economics. And I know that like the amount they go into obviously would be very different, but I just don't know like what has the potential to get faster than the same.
Well, it's a sort of vague.
And it's very generic.
Yes,
so
exactly. Sort of. No, I would think if you really work with the texts like we did in the seminar to show that you've, you know, got the gist, and of course I will make allowances for, you know, for example, the first marks text being very difficult, so I mean you have, that's also actually an issue with the second literature, because these texts are so open to interpretation, a lot of them, you have a lot of different positions on them, so I actually would recommend that people just simply try to work with their understanding of those specific texts and say, this is how I read this, you know, Freud says this, or Marx says that, or Nietzsche says the other thing, here's a quote, this is my understanding, this is one of the things, this has to do with the essay question. Because my experience is that sometimes if you send people off to read the second with it, it can actually be more confusing than actually help. I will still try to give you some titles and, you know, especially things that are available electronically, because I assume many of you will also want to leave very soon and go home and not necessarily be near the library, so I mean, I'll do a mix, but I'll make sure there's also some online sources. I won't be able to do that before next week, though. But basically, what I would want to see isn't so much people reading tons of stuff on Nietzsche or something, but really work with the text and, you know, the questions that they've chosen, and just, you know, try to develop their own take on it. I mean, I've taught the Marx in America in English at the University of Chicago. And their students are expressly forbidden to use secondary material because they really want them to engage with the primary material rather than just giving, because there is so much out there, you know, giving a potted collection of what everybody else is saying. So, that, because of course, the primary aim is for you to engage with the text.
Would you put a maximum on how many sources of secondary literature we should use then to avoid that?
I wouldn't want to like limit you, but it's definitely not the case that the more sources, the better the work. So it really depends on the quality of your argument. And in this course, I mean, if you do finally a course on literature, say imperial or whatever, we do say, well, you know, we really want you to look at some of these secondary lit, because it's also not so difficult, and you know, and people also in the final year can be expected to be able to say, okay, X says this about whatever Ibsen's Doll's House. And I actually disagree. So there we would say, you know, use at least whatever five sources, and some people do a lot more. I definitely wouldn't put an upper limit. I would just caution against going too crazy on thinking you have to read everything, because I think in the end it might actually be confusing. And I would be much less directive in terms.
terms of how many secondary sources. So I would say if somebody doesn't use any secondary sources, but you can really see they've engaged with the primary texts, they've come to quite a good understanding, they really made their own argument that relates to the question, then, you know, I would give that a first. At the same time, if you do find some useful secondary sources and use them in a meaningful way, you know, of course that's also good. So it really, I would think it all depends on how you use sources, if you use them, and if it really contributes to you making a good argument or not.
I think what I'm just a bit worried about is, so because they're not like literary texts, I'm not really sure like what type of thesis you'd be able to have, like, because it's not like a representation of something. It's like clearly what they've written is what they think, rather than like trying to, or like seeing metaphors,
yeah,
you might,
exactly.
Or like, so like if it's a literary text, you might say that something stands for what, like similar to what they're actually writing. So, like, what kind of things can you argue? Like, because the question that I'm interested in is the compare and contrast one. So I don't really feel like there would be of the religion. I don't really feel like there would be like a specific thesis in the way that I might have one for like reading a literary text or poem or something like that. Do you know what I mean? Does anyone know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, like, I know that I'll be able to say the ways in which they're similar and different and the reasons why, but I mean, can like an actual argument be formed out of that?
I don't know, just reading in terms of imperial essays on compare and contrast the way gender relations are represented in two novels or plays of your choice, so usually it's Ibsen and somebody else. And there as well, I mean, yeah, maybe part of the essay would also be a bit more, okay, this is a sort of, you know, in the setting you can find a reflection of the actual hierarchical structures of how husband and wife relate, or or, you know, whatever the pet names are belittling and therefore reflective of a sort of perception of gender. But the basic problem that you end up with an argument that says, well, on the one hand there are all these commonalities, on the other hand there are all these differences. And then the question is, do you have a sort of overarching thesis beyond that? Well, you actually don't necessarily need one if you do that well. It's kind of similar, so I wonder if the problem is the compare and contrast question, or that this is not actually, or is the problem that you feel because we're not trying to sort of reach through a literary text to a sort of underlying meaning, but we're just operating on the level of the actual argument,
yeah,
that there's nothing for you to do.
For me, that's so strange. Like, I was thinking about these, and I was like, I feel like I can't go deeper than what I think it's trying to say. And for me, that, like, I'm like, well, to me, that wouldn't be, like, it would,
that
can't be
true. Yeah,
it would be, more of a commentary than like a very profound analysis. I don't think I don't feel like capable of doing that, because I don't think there's anything to, there's no like hidden meaning or like symbolism.
Well, but you would still by sort of checking out, well, how is whatever Freud actually different from Nietzsche, and where are they in parallel, and what do I actually think of their specific differences, for example, you would still tease out aspects that aren't necessarily so visible, right, if you just read one text on its own, I would think. And you would sort of find structures that maybe are only visible once you start comparing them to each other.
I was trying to, well, I was thinking about doing the one text, because I find them like, there is quite a lot to them, and I thought there might be enough, but do you reckon that if that two texts could sort of give way to more complex debates?
Well, it depends a bit on what you do with them. Sometimes I find that comparing two texts actually is almost easier, because it forces you to look at both of them from a slightly different perspective, and, you know, adding new questions if you want.
Mm.
So sometimes that's easier than to see things you might not have seen in the texts when you just looked at them on their own. But it really depends on what question appeals to you in a way. And I wouldn't be too worried about, oh, you can't kind of find more than what's already on the page, because I think the texts are kind of challenging enough that if you actually do that well, you know, there's definitely a lot of your own thinking and work in there then. And, you know, manage to tease out what is exactly relevant to the question and how would I structure that and present it, and maybe, you know, even you form your own view while you're doing that, or what you think of it. But, you know, is this a progressive or a problematic text? Does this have implications that might not be
sort of... Yeah, so is that kind of how you put your own argument on it? Because that's what I was thinking. Obviously, I think that sometimes there's like loopholes in the arguments of the both, or like looking at them.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from rather than actually being like, they both do this and this means this at the beginning of the essay, and then being like, and this shows how they do this, rather than like just actually saying, well, I'm going to compare them and look at similarities and differences to like highlight other things. I don't know.
That made no sense.
You know what I mean? Like, rather than, so like in another essay I might say like, oh, I'm going to look at the use of blah to highlight how blah. In the introduction I'm kind of saying like, I don't feel like I would be able to, I feel like the argument will be throughout rather than like, building up to one big argument.
Oh, but there won't be one proper thesis.
Yeah,
oh,
so like, it'll be like looking at concepts and then within that one thing saying what you think of it, whether it works, or how they compare to each other and why they've got different ideas.
And like in the intro,
ideas.
You might need to give a little bit more conclusion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So is it different in that sense that that's okay to like, build it up throughout rather than be quite directive in the introduction?
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, it's kind of never best practice anyway to say in the introduction, oh, I'm going to do... Well, actually, to have a thesis, if you have one, it's nice, but sometimes you get these introductions that say, oh, in my essay I will do the following four steps. First I will do 1, 2, 3, and 4, and then the conclusion says that I did 1, 2, 3, and 4. But if you do the comparison well, and maybe you come up with things that weren't visible to you before, or maybe to a sort of naive reader, that's perfectly fine. But you might find anyway that, you know, in doing that, you end up with, for example, I don't know, say you write about Freud and, Freud and Nietzsche are both pretty scathing of religion. If you wrote about the relationships of individual and society in the two, right? You probably end up finding, I don't want to be too sort of narrow your view of the two authors, but it's probably not too far-fetched that, say, for Nietzsche, society appears almost universal as negative. So there you have these visions of some kind of vague liberation with the Übermensch and so on. But for Freud, your work really, it's all about, well, we can't quite get this relationship entirely right, so there is just no complete happiness. I mean, that's what comes out of the Überhang, right? So we just have to tweak and work on how exactly can we strike the balance between individual freedom and social necessity. And maybe, you know, in the conclusion you then felt like, well, I want to come down on one side or the other. Sort of one view might be more progressive or productive if you actually want to talk about how society might look than the other. And, you know, that could be a conclusion. Of course, that wouldn't summarize in one sentence everything we've done so far, but it would sort of take your analysis and go beyond it. So in that way, I think it could come to a conclusion that's truly yours. or, you know, for example, Nietzsche seems to have pretty clear views of how men really are, and they're very, seem to be quite positive towards some kind of mythical past, whereas, well, certainly my reading of Marx would be that there is no notion of naturally people are like that and society just spoils them, but it's more like society as it is betrays people, how do you say that in English? It denies people to fully develop their own potential, so it's a much more future directed view when you could, you know, come to some view on at the end sort of what you find more interesting or productive or the meta-analysis in that respect. And that would still be a product of a fairly complex comparison. Does that address your question?
Yeah, that's a good question. And can you, like, obviously these were written for a time, can you talk about, can you relate it very much to like our experience?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Okay, so it doesn't need to be like conjecturally based in, can you take the ideas and obviously put it to the modern day as in like modernity now rather than then?
I think so. I mean, you should make maybe an argument where you think it applies.
Okay.
But, I mean, my sense is that they all, I mean, they're all talking about the early stages of the society we still live in, right? Many people say, for example, this thing that we also discussed in Marx with the roller coaster being next to the production process, or potentially, that that's actually much truer now than it was in his time, in a way. So, and I think, you know, with Freud, also, I mean, we've moved beyond a very rigid Victorian sexual morality, but some of the basic conflicts that he describes, you know, you can't just live out your drives, otherwise society would fall apart, so what you do with that contradiction would still exist. So, I mean, say you were writing about Freud, you could maybe nod towards the fact that you're aware that, yeah, okay, you know, homosexuality is now brought in the same way in a lot of Western societies as it was in his day, but you still have restrictions on sexuality. So, does that make sense? So to kind of be show that you are aware that there's some historical change, but I think all of them can still say something. I mean, I'm just a fan of Nietzsche, but you know, you can still see sort of where his criticism comes from, even if you look at the contemporary society. Or you could imagine how somebody might be a Nietzschean today and still feel, oh, this is too restrictive, this is too much of a mass society, this doesn't give enough room for the strong known, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I definitely think you can connect it to present day developments. Actually, that would be very interesting if you feel that, you know, there's material for that. Maybe that could have been a question, even, but you can, you know, sort of, do you think X or Y still has relevance today? But I think you can make those links in any of the questions where you think they are appropriate. Should we maybe go through some of the questions and talk a little bit about how one might approach these? Would that be useful to you? Did anybody have tried to think about the first question? I know this is the text that people found on average most challenging, but
maybe we should see what questions.
Yeah, okay.
Because
yeah,
I rolled that one out.
Okay. Do you wanna just give us a quick
No, I meant
oh, you
yeah,
ruled it out. Okay, so let's skip it. If we have some time, I can tell you what I had in mind with that question, but I don't want to take too much time away from the other ones. So, did anybody even, as a vague option, think about question two?
Yeah.
Yeah? So, how would you approach it?
Well, I was thinking, I'd like to first show why how he says it's an important characteristic of modern society, the division of labour, and then maybe argue his why he thinks is positive or negative in terms of social progress and progress, and then for the well-being of the, each member of the society as well. And then I was going to maybe use Schiller just with the
if I felt it was necessary.
Can you say a bit more on that?
Whereas the division of labour, he might have thought it was positive because I don't know, I haven't really got that close to the text, but I'm sure there are reasons why he said it's positive, and then he says negative because it creates classes, and it means that there's like it creates a proletarian. And then with Schiller, I would argue that he would say the division of labour was negative because it means that people only train their one faculty and the rest of their faculties diminished as a result of that. And then that's like another viewpoint on why it was negative.
Yeah, maybe we can add some aspects to that. So if I understand you correctly, your idea was to also divide the essay in that way, right? Sort of first try to see is there anything for Marx that would be positive about the division of labour? And then is there anything that would be negative? And of course the two things positive for the progress of society as a whole, however you would define that, or positive for the individual, they might not point in the same direction either. So any ideas if Marx has anything to say on positive effects of the division of labour for society as a whole, or potentially positive ones?
It speeds up the whole process because it can become very slow and quick in one thing. The end product, although the individual doesn't see it, which is the negative of the individual, like the societal growth is much faster.
Right, progress, productivity rises faster, all those things. So you could use the Grundrisse for that, for example, to give some textual evidence. And Ellie, you seem to feel that if you look at what's actually the experience of the individual, the picture is much less Joker. And so one reason you said was okay, or I'm not sure if you would put that down under society as a whole, individual, the formation of classes, you might rather see that as a point for society as a whole, right? So that would then also go into that section. How about the effects on the individual?
The individual becomes, he says, they get less intelligent. Is that one of his points?
Certainly under conditions of alienated labour, yeah. So impoverishes the experience of the worker, they get kind of one-sided, pretty much also like what you just mentioned from Schiller. I mean, in that sense, Marx and Schiller really worked with the green.
I have a question, I think it's really relevant. So, you know, there are actual psychological studies that have been done over the past few decades, that are just if a worker doesn't see a product through to the end, their work satisfaction is lower, their ability to just, it was their whole mental health as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be anything you could, something along those lines? Could you ever refer to that?
Yeah,
to say that it still brings trauma in society or something?
I would definitely say, yeah, that seems immediately relevant because it seems to confirm exactly the thesis that Marx has here, that it takes away from your experience of your own labour in a way if the product is just taken from you the moment you've sort of turned your two screws, and so it changes your relationship to what you produce and your relationship to your own activity. So it seems to be completely relevant.
It's quite so these essays, I feel it's quite open before we had
yeah.
In fact, if we can refer to a psychological study for.
Yeah, I think that would be perfectly fine. But likewise, if you just really want to focus on the texts themselves, I think that's also fine. So basically what we, in terms of lecturers, tutors, want to see is just that, you're able to understand the texts and you're able to somehow critically engage with them and develop your own thoughts. And if those thoughts are purely based on the texts themselves, but they're interesting and they're adequate and you didn't just sort of ignore half the text or completely misread everything. Or if you think, yesterday in the paper I read the following and that seems to be exactly what what Nietzsche's on about, or Zimmer or whatever, you know, that's also then, you know, a sign that you've engaged with it critically and creatively.
I think it would be good to like look at that close reading. I'm a bit worried that like the issue of plagiarism, because I don't think like, how do you know that you're not excellent in like using an idea that's like obviously out there? And then like trying to say like, oh, I didn't read any secondary literature, and you might not have, but I don't know, how do you kind of get around that? Because I feel like there's going to be a lot of arguments that probably will be out there as like known arguments or responses to these texts,
mm-hmm.
And I'm just a bit worried that like the issue of plagiarism, because you could have written it yourself, but the ideas might be like exactly the same.
Well, I mean, I don't, since this is not a PhD, I don't actually expect that each of you in the second year essay will move scholarship beyond where it has been so far, especially on authors like these, where there's whole libraries on each of them. So in that sense, I don't necessarily expect you to say stuff that nobody has ever said before. And the other question, of course, you're right, is sort of, because it's so hard to say something on these guys that nobody ever has thought of, especially on a fairly narrow textual basis and so on. Is it a problem that you might be repeating stuff that can be found elsewhere? And I mean, that's, in a way, that's always a problem with especially undergrad essays, because of course we normally say, well, if you have it from somewhere, please reference it. And it's always kind of, we always to some degree just have to rely on you actually doing that. And often you can kind of tell. I mean, sometimes people, if it's badly done, you know, you have a really bad essay that you can see, the text isn't really understood, and then there is suddenly one paragraph in there that, you know, is terribly reminiscent of this one piece of secondary literature, but it's not referenced. So
yeah.
You know, that makes you kind of wonder. But there is a pretty bright gray zone where, you know, also for us it's hard to see. So. But yeah, as I said, I mean, I wouldn't expect that you reinvent the wheel or invent something that comes after the wheel, because somebody has already invented the wheel, so to speak. And usually you can kind of tell simply from the way in which the ideas are related to the primary text. You know, if this is kind of all of one piece, and if this is plausibly the student's own work. I mean, mostly if people sort of just plonk bits they take from the internet into their own text, and nothing really kind of it doesn't really hold together very well. So
obviously, because you'll have that textual reference for the primary sources anyway.
So
you do that, it's
exactly. So if you suddenly come up with a huge elaborate thesis about what Nietzsche really thought, but you're not able to, you know, give a single piece of evidence for that from the text you read or another text, then that would be problem. And then in a way, you know, I don't need to know if you had that from somewhere else or not, because it simply as an argument it wouldn't be good. Does that help?
Mm-hmm.
I think we haven't quite finished your thing, but I think the approach is precisely right, and also, you know, that you say, well, Zimmer, not so similar, Schiller seems to say similar things, even though it's all very brief and abbreviated. And also, one further thing that I just wanted to add that one could add here is the whole idea of what does it do to people if their relation to their own consumption and to other people is all mediated through exchange. I mean, Schiller very briefly mentions that in a somewhat cryptic way, sort of the means and the ends are all inverted, and Marx says a lot more about that. So these would all be things you could integrate into your essay. What other questions do people think about?
Four?
Which one controls the theory and critique of religion and all domain studies and morality? So what would you look at there, and have you had any thoughts about how you would structure that?
establishing a theory within the religion part, and then
so where does it come from? Why do we have it in the first place?
Yeah.
How did it develop, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, and then because I feel like anyway, the critique of religion is always related to the morals, that
right.
The idea of morality.
That's why
that's being created. Yeah. So kind of just develop it through in that way. I suppose until today I hadn't really thought about that, going that step further, and then after comparing and contrasting, maybe say which theory or text I think is more like illuminating, progressive or useful within a modern context of what the elements.
I mean, don't feel you absolutely have to do that. But you definitely don't have to come down on one side or the other. So you might end up thinking, well, they both have something going for them, or they're
yeah,
both completely
like
off the wall, or
yeah.
Aspects, or exactly. Or mine's more convincing, even though it might still be no longer applicable today, or, you know, whatever. So there is really no set
yeah.
thing that we expect to see or anything like that.
Do you think it'd be going away from the question if you like investigated how their critique of religion is a result of their views on morality? Like on their theory of morality? Do you think that's like changing the question? If you like.
No. I mean, clearly in the way they criticise. I mean, the one thing that's not quite clear to me what you just said was the division between the religion and the morality. So maybe if you want to say a bit more about that? I mean, if it's just about how does the critique and the theory, how it comes about, interrelate, I would say no, they're definitely, I mean, they're almost impossible to separate, right? I mean, if you look at Nietzsche and says, okay, this is all about the uprising of the slaves to control the ones that are strong and healthy and so on, I mean, there you have almost the critique and the theory of the genesis in one, so there's, not only would it be possible, it would be very hard to talk about the one without the other. But on the relationship of morality and religion, I would be kind of with Hannah in thinking, well, they're actually very closely related in the systems of religion, kind of give you moral imperatives and rules, and just that you can also have a system of moral values without it specifically being religious. That's why I sort of left that open. Because what Freud talks about is on the one hand.
He kind of thinks it's the other way around.
Yeah. Do you want to go on with
that? Well, I feel like Nietzsche's view is that it's imposed on us, and we have a choice, and that's how like good and bad is, or good and evil has like come about. Because Freud, well, it's different, isn't it? Because Nietzsche sees it as like a societal problem, whereas Freud sees it as like a psychological problem. Like they look at the whole thing where he looks at religion as like a replacement for the father, and like morals, like forming in different ways.
But it's both, isn't it? Because he also has this argument. We need a system of morality, very often reinforced by religion, in order to keep society going. Like when he talks about the death row, for example,
mm-hmm.
like we need certain rules to make sure people do not just kill each other. So it's never entirely divorced from the necessity of somehow living together with others and so on. But, you know, that might be another link between the two. I mean, generally, with all these compare and contrast type questions, we discussed that in the office already, Hannah and I, you also always have to think a bit about, well, how do I want to structure this? Do I first want to present one and then the other? Or do I want to try to identify different aspects that I will then look at in both texts and structure it like that? that makes sense, or do I want to give a sort of brief overview of each and then do that and go into different things we can look at? And it's, again, there is no hard and fast rule what's best, so it really depends on how your argument develops, and sometimes you start one way and then realize, well, that doesn't actually work quite that well, maybe I need to do it the other way. But it's worth keeping that in mind, that on the one hand you want to, of course, be able to still explain what somebody is saying, which is sometimes easier if you don't just take it all apart and just look at different aspects completely separately. But on the other hand, you also want to create a sort of structure for your argument that makes it possible for you to compare. So it's worth just sitting back a bit and thinking, well, in what respects can I actually compare this? Oh, I think that's something else here. Shall we briefly move, or do you think you've had enough and we just stop it there? I hope the other room is short. Shall we just wander down the corridor and we'll finish up? Of course, there's no obligation at all for this to be. Sorry.